Just to note for those who are visiting with us, we have begun a discussion of what we refer to as desirable characteristics that are personified by various Bible characters. And we have discussed in our study up to this point the mind of Christ, the humility of Solomon, the hearing of Mary, as she said at Jesus' feet, the seeking of the Bereans, and we are discussing presently the choice that Moses made as described in Hebrews chapter 11. So I'd like you to turn with me there to Hebrews 11. And we began our discussion last week. That was a possibility, a good possibility that we'll get through it this evening. And so we'll get into our next discussion, which would be the faith of Abraham. But there are a few other things that I want to talk about with regard to Moses' choice. We talked about the faith of Moses. We talked about faith in general, because that's the context of Hebrews chapter 11. We'll have opportunity, actually, to talk more about faith as a subject when we get into our next lesson, the faith of Abraham. Romans chapter 4 emphasizes especially justification by faith as contrasted with earning your standing before God as was necessary under the Old Covenant. Contrast is being made between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant in Romans chapter 4, and it is described as works versus faith, earning your salvation versus justification by faith. So we'll be talking a little bit about that as we get into the discussion of the faith of Abraham. But I wanted you to note, as we started last week, we looked at the beginning of Hebrews chapter 11 and the description that is given of faith in verses 1 and following, especially verse 1, that faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And we talked about that as not being necessarily a definition of faith, but rather the relationship that faith sustains to those things for which we hope and those things which we do not see. It is the substance and the evidence of those things. And then in the text of Hebrews chapter 11, there is a series of individuals, the Old Testament patriarchs and men and women of renown, that were justified before God as a result of their faith. And he describes the circumstances of each of these. And it's very good to correlate Hebrews 11 with James chapter 2, because it's approaching the discussion from two different directions, but getting to the same place. Individuals who have faith exhibit their faith by their obedience. That's what the Hebrew writer is emphasizing, the importance of faith. And it's simply established that the way in which these individuals showed their faith was through their obedience. Moses, that we're discussing in our lesson this evening, is a good example of that. When he said, by faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. So it's obvious as you look at these texts, it is by faith that these things are accomplished. And really, the writer of the Hebrew letters is not interested particularly in establishing the necessity of obedience as an outgrowth of faith. That's a given. If a person is faithful, if a person has faith, he's going to act in a particular way. Now, James, when he approaches the subject, it is for the purpose of arguing the position that faith that is separate from obedience, faith without works, is dead, being alone. And he uses some of the same examples, so specifically Abraham and Rahab the harlot, to explain the same principle that is taken for granted by the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 11. You look at these individuals, they are what we might refer to as heroes of faith. Well, how do you know that they're heroes of faith? Look at how they responded to the request of God, the requirements of God. It's obvious that these were individuals of faith. By faith, Abraham did this. By faith, Sarah did that. By faith, Moses did what he did. Whereas in James, he's saying, you're talking about faith as if it's something separate and apart from obedience. And I'm telling you that faith is dead faith unless the obedience is present. So he's arguing the issue. And so he's coming from it, emphasizing or seeking to establish the necessity of works and accompanying faith, that it be a living faith. And the Hebrew writer's not doing that, but they get to the same place and they basically teach the same thing as we see it. So we're going to talk about the choice that Moses made that was the outgrowth of his faith. And we actually talked about a lot of the other in our lesson last week, but we didn't actually get to the choice. We ran out of time before we looked at the choice itself. So that's what I want to do in the lesson this evening. So you'll notice again, specifically verses 24 through 27, by faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Now, in looking at this text, just to make sure that we understand the two choices, the first choice that is mentioned here, the one that he took, in other words, what he decided to do was to suffer the affliction, or to suffer affliction, with the people of God. It is described in the text as the reproach of Christ. The idea of sharing the affliction is enduring it with them. So he was chose to be one of them, and as they suffered, he suffered. It is referred to as the reproach of Christ. The second choice, the road not taken, was to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. That is described here as the treasures that are in Egypt and the riches that are to be found in Egypt. So we want to look at the choice because it's one, I think, that that each of us perhaps struggle with ourselves in our day. Not maybe to the extent that Moses. I'm not saying that each of us would have to choose, in effect, affliction to the extent of almost losing your life. Of course, the children of Israel were in danger as a result of the reproach of Pharaoh. Nor can we say that we have the hope of obtaining possibly the riches that Moses could have obtained as being the son of Pharaoh's daughter. But what we're talking about here is making a choice as to where our priorities will be. And I think the very clear choice that's under consideration here, if you're going to generalize or establish broad categories, is Christ or the world. Righteousness, spirituality, service to God, or materialism, worldliness, that which the world has to offer, which is something that is extremely appealing to individuals. And if you put it in those broad terms, and I were to ask any Christian, which do you choose? Then any Christian I ask would say, I choose Christ. And I would be willing to give up all of that for Christ. And yet, worldliness and materialism and covetousness, these things are among the most problematic sins and temptations to sin that we find among God's people today. And so what I want you to understand is that there is a difference between saying, I choose Christ, without making a lot of change with regard to the life that you're living, and doing like Moses did. And Moses, when he made his choice, it was something that was sharply delineated. We've talked already last week about as he became of age and he went out to look at his people and to observe the circumstances they found themselves in, that he saw an Israelite being beaten by an Egyptian, and he killed the Egyptian. And that necessitated him leaving Egypt. He had to be a fugitive as a result of that. And of course, it altered entirely the remainder of his life. No longer, from that point on, did he ever make his abode in a soft palace. There was no luxury. It was a difficult life that he lived from that point on, a life of austerity. Well, you know, that was the case through the period of time that he was away from Egypt. It was that way during the period of time preceding the Exodus, and it certainly was that way as they went through the wilderness. And so it was a very real decision that was made on his part. And so that's where I think that we need to make the emphasis here with regard to making such a choice like Moses made, is to recognize that there is a very real consequence to saying, I'm going to live for Christ. I'm going to choose, if necessary, to suffer for Christ, because that means giving up. It means sacrifice. And I'm not going to in any way equate what we, in our very posh circumstances, in the society in which we live, the liberties we have, freedom that we enjoy, as well as our prosperity, to equate that with what God's people have suffered in times past. But you know, as do I, that there are times when our choice to serve God, makes it necessary that we practice discipline and experience sacrifice and perhaps even suffer at least a modicum of persecution as a result of our willingness to put Christ first. And there has to always be that willingness there. But the point is that as we make that contention, that if we do that, there will be times when we will suffer as a result of the choice that we made, if we truly made a choice. And so it's something you need to think about. Is it ever something that is required of you? Are you ever acting in a sacrificial way as a result of your faith? Because if you're not, then there may be something that's amiss there. Again, not trying to equate it with what others have suffered for the cause, but when we're talking about giving sacrificially, on the first day of the week, when it talks about sacrificing our time, when it talks about esteeming others more highly than ourselves and looking out for others' interests as well as our own, when it talks about the need to evangelize, all of these things are impactful of our time, our circumstance, and choice necessitates sometimes us giving up things as a result of what Christ requires of us. And so it's a pretty high example that we are to seek to emulate here. And I just feel like sometimes we give lip service to it, but perhaps we're not thinking about exactly what the cost is and how great that cost might be. Right?
We're talking about sacrifice. I think the longer you go as a Christian, it's almost like the less you notice it, or the less it becomes a sacrifice. Certain things are sort of automatic. You just made up your mind that's the way you're going to do. You don't think about coming to services as being a sacrifice of your time. After a while, maybe you do in the beginning, but after a while it becomes what you do. And the same thing with your finances, it just becomes what you do. And it's less a conscious sacrifice. You don't feel like you're doing it without anything. You feel like it's kind of a privilege to do some things that maybe a younger Christian or somebody who's not a Christian can't imagine you doing that or acting that way.
Yeah, I think it's important that, and I may not have differentiated this, I'm not saying that to be a Christian you have to be miserable. And if you're not being miserable, you're not being a good Christian. That's not the point at all. In fact, that's a very valid point that Roger has made, if anyone was unable to hear it, is that for an individual who's a mature Christian, those things you give up do not seem to be sacrificial. In other words, it's not something that you resent or seem to be hard for you because of your love and your interest in the things of God. And I would say that very probably was the case with Moses as well. I don't think that we can look at the text and indicate from that Moses was in any way resentful or sorry for what he did when he made that choice. Even as great as those things were, in fact, that's one of the major points that I want to make in regard to this, is when you're comparing the earthly treasures to the heavenly treasures, that there's not really any way to compare the relative values, because what we have and what we will obtain as a result of the relationship we sustain with Christ far exceeds anything that we're giving up. It's just a matter of acknowledging the fact that those things must be given up. The problem arises when an individual thinks that I can have heaven and I can have the heavenly rewards and still maintain my allegiance and love for the world and worldly things. Because you can't do that. You can't have both. Now, if you have, you know, someone says you can have this, you know, this brand new luxury car, or you can have this old Pinto. Now, Roger may be the one that would choose the Pinto among all of us, but you got this old beat up old car that barely runs, and you can't have both of them. Well, so, okay, well, I'll do it without the Pinto, and I'll get the luxury car, you know. And we understand that with the relative value. It's kind of silly in looking at it that way that someone say, no, I want both, and maybe even jeopardize the possibility of getting a luxury car because you're so insistent on holding on to the little Pinto, you know. But that's exactly, you know, what so many are doing. It's because it's a little bit more esoteric. The value is not there shining and revving its engine to where we can just look at it and say to ourselves, well, that's a lot more valuable. But the Bible is replete with such assurances and warnings. I mean, when Jesus said, what is man profited if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? The value of an eternal abode in God's presence, the hope of heaven, is something that far exceeds anything that this world has to offer. And yet we have many who struggle with that concept of worldliness. Now again, it's not something that is greatly acknowledged, which is why I said at the beginning of our study, you know, if I were to ask any Christian, which do you want? They're going to say, I want Jesus. But how many times have you had Christians missing worship or neglecting some aspect of their responsibility as a Christian because of work or because of a recreation or because of something that is pressing at that particular time in their life? And they're basically saying, at this point in time, I count that to be more valuable or more important than this thing that is yet to be achieved, something that is in the future, something spiritual in nature. So it is a problem, which is why the Bible warns against materialism, warns against worldliness time and time and time again. Love for the world makes you an enemy of God, and it's something we need to acknowledge. And Moses had to make that decision. It was kind of forced on him in a sense. But really, it is something God requires of us as well. It's just that sometimes people are... I think basically what they're doing is fooling themselves. You're using rationalization and excuse to justify having a foot in both places. And while it's something that you think that you can juggle acceptably, if you're trying to juggle it, that's putting you in the wrong realm. That's something that God in and of itself says is not acceptable. And something we need to acknowledge. So trying to make some application with regard to what Moses chose and how that impacts us as well. Yes.
You know, along that line, as you mentioned earlier about people who do these great things with Christ or all these things in chapter 11, I would be there, you know, but that makes me think of the King General Nathan that had the leprosy and went to Elijah and told him to dip in the Jordan River seven times, I raised, and the servant, wouldn't you do some great thing? Well, the little thing, if I was a root, well, we could buy that, we do the great things, we serve you with anyway, but the missed services and all those things that you just mentioned a few moments ago.
The little things are things that sometimes we shake at.
So. Yeah, and so that doesn't really go along with doing the great thing, being the little thing, you know.
Good point. Yes,
we haven't talked about it yet, but this verse 26, where the writer gives Moses credit for esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. And that's kind of a remarkable, I think.
In what way is he?
Well, I'm not sure whether Moses had a clear picture of the Christ about exactly what was going to happen in future. I mean, Moses knew he needed to obey God.
I did want to talk about it, so let's do bring that up. As Roger's indicating, this phrase in verse 26 of the text, that he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater than the riches of Egypt. So the reproach of Christ indicates, of course, Christ as the anointed. But let's remember in our history where they were. this was before the law was given. Now, there were intimations already present concerning the coming of an anointed one. Genesis chapter 3, Genesis chapter 12 would be two examples. One with regard to the various things said concerning the serpent and bruising the head of the serpent and him bruising the heel of the man or the seed of woman. And also in Genesis chapter 12 with regard to Abraham's promises granted to him that in his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed. So the seed's there, but when we talk about the anointed, especially the use of the term Christ and such, it's obvious that the realization of Christ as Jesus of Nazareth, the anointed of God, that comes in the fullness of time, is something that would not be present in the mind of Moses at the point in time he made this choice. But what I think is important to note, and in fact, this I think is borne out somewhat. You'll notice in go down to verse 39 of the text. Verse 39 of the text. All of these, having reference to Moses, including others, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Going on down into the 12th chapter, talks about we, since we're surrounded by that great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside these things, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. These individuals, it could be said, they saw through a veil darkly. They had an intimation of redemption, an understanding that obedience to God would ultimately save them. Salvation is attained through Jesus Christ. And so it doesn't matter how long ago they lived. It doesn't matter where in that line concerning the scheme of redemption that they might be. Throughout that entire period, individuals who turned to God were esteeming the reproach of Christ greater than whatever the world had to offer for them. They were all making that choice. And although it very well may be that Moses had sufficient knowledge of the promise to Abraham, that he was aware that the Israelites were the chosen of God, that redemption for mankind would come through them, it's not necessary that we accept or believe that Moses had a full understanding at that point in time he made that choice of the Christ, the anointed to come, to say that it's appropriate that he made that choice and it to be categorized in that way. That's the Hebrew writer categorizing what it was that he did. When he chose God and he chose to suffer with the people of God, he chose the reproach of Christ. Mm-hmm. Rather than the riches that were available to him in that regard, so it is an interesting language that is used. But I think that's Hebrew writer saying all these people, because he brings it into the 12th chapter as to the responsibility to us. But all of these people, they chose Christ before Christ ever came, and that was the choice that they made when they believed in God. Now you have this example of all these people, but you are on the other side of it. They were not made perfect apart from you. The reason why they have redemption is because of what has been already obtained for you. You're on the other side of Christ on the cross. And so, since that is the case, it's almost, if they were able to do it, you should be even more able to do it because of what you know. They didn't get it, but you got it. So they didn't have the benefits that you have. That's one of the things that the Hebrew writer is emphasizing. While we talk about the book of Hebrews as being a contrast between the things of old and the better things of the new. Because we got it better than they had it. And he even indicates that here in this text. So yes, Abraham, when he chose what he chose to side with Christ. Even if he did not have a full understanding at that point in time. Of the nature of redemption. Now, having said that, by the end of his life, if any Israelite did know and fully understand the nature of redemption before Christ came, it would have been Moses the lawgiver. But this was early on in his life when he made that choice.
Quick comment about Moses, who did not take the riches of Egypt. I think that in James 4:4, in one sentence, it says it all. I'll read the verse. It says, do you not know that friendship with the world is in enmity with God?
Yeah. And as I said, you're making yourself the enemy by making that choice, by having that friendship with the world. And he chose the right thing. Yes, Josh.
The two verses here, enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin, and also treasures of Egypt. Both of those things in themselves are not necessarily sin. The pleasures of sin may not necessarily mean fornication or total debauchery, whatnot. It's whatever comes between you and your Lord. Because there are, even now, right now, back at my home office, the one that I started out of, they're holding a meeting right now that I'm actually expected to be at. I'm not there. And the rationale is they even use scripture, and I've been berated by it several times, and I'm not saying that to be boastful or anything, because it's not fun. God wouldn't send you to hell for one meeting that's going to help you in your business so you can provide for your family like he told you to.
Oh, that's a wonderful rationale.
So, it's not necessarily that making a meeting is sinful. It's, does it come in the way of your service?
Yeah, there are lots of things like that that in themselves are not inherently sinful, but if they usurp that place that God has and is that, then it becomes
sinful. And the sin in that case would, yeah, maybe it would be helpful to my business and I would have the fleeting pleasure of a few more bucks in my pocket than, and I might be able to buy my wife a bigger ring or whatever, though she doesn't like that. it would still be fleeting compared to what I gain by being here.
Yeah, so there are those two things. Anything that comes between you and the Lord is sinful because it becomes between you and the Lord, whether inherently it's sinful or not. Now, there are many sinful things that accompany that are inherently sinful, but some that are not. Secondly, and this is one thing I did want to mention that Josh brought up, is the fleeting pleasures. That means it's transitory. It means that it has no lasting value. And that's where the devil gets us. It's one of those things that and a lot of us have this problem. We have a difficult time, using money as an example, saving for something of value because that that's cheap is right there. And I've explained this or illustrated this with regard to small children. You can make children real happy by taking them to the dollar store and give them a dollar and let them get a toy. And the toy didn't last 15 minutes, but they're real happy for 15 minutes, you know. And I don't know. I would suppose that you could say, give them a dollar. You can that dollar spend now and give you $5 to spend, next year, and they're going to want the dollar, And a lot of us are that way. In that regard. But the idea of this is that no matter what it is, if it seems to be of lasting value, that's just the patina that the devil puts on it to make it alluring to us. And in reality, there is no lasting value to sin. And that's why this was so much better. And that's why that statement that I made, that the Lord, or I said the Lord, quoted from the Lord, that what does man profit he gains, the whole world loses his own soul. That's why that's true. Because what you have, when you gain the whole world, you have only for your lifetime. And even in your lifetime, because of the fact that money can't spare you aches and pains and the dissolution of health and those kinds of things, it's transitory and as such is limited in its value. When you compare that with the eternal nature of the soul, and the eternal benefit of being God's presence in heaven, there's just no comparison because of that as regards to value, the ultimate value between the two. That's right.
Trying to think of a word that bridges that gap between that Pinto and that Rolls Royce. It may not be a Rolls Royce, maybe it's a magic carpet. And we don't know what it is because we can't see it. But what bridges that gap is trust. And when we lose that trust, we're going to go grab the tempo.
Yeah. Okay, good. Then maybe that's it. Maybe some Christians, their faith, because it's faith here that we're talking about, is not sufficient for them to trust in the promises of God. Because if we really and fully buy into this idea that God has said we're going to get heaven, so we're going to get it, then it makes it a lot easier. And when you see faithful Christians, it goes back to what Roger said at the beginning. If you've got someone who's a mature Christian who's bought into it, it doesn't seem sacrificial to him at all, because he knows what he's going to obtain as a result of it. He trusts in that. God promised it. God always delivers on his promises. And so I know that I'm going to have heaven. And I'm willing to give up anything. And it's just a mild, small thing because of what I can gain as a result of it.
Yeah, I got one more point here. Maybe nobody's interested in this but me, but I thought that phrase about the reproach of Christ was interesting. And I've got another translation here, New English Bible, that it doesn't have verse numbers, so there, here it is. He considered the stigma that rests on God's anointed greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for his eyes were fixed upon the coming day. It doesn't say Christ. It says God's anointed. God's anointed, yeah. And I'm thinking that God has had a lot of anointings over, not in the same sense as Christ, but you know, Saul and David are anointed for God's work. And every time you're doing God's work, you got some stigma. There's somebody that's always working against you. You can see that throughout history.
Yeah.
And I wondered if maybe that wasn't a better translation or better consideration that the in this case, Moses was, or just maybe a parallel thought. Moses was anointed to do God's work.
If
he could have rejected that and had pleasures, or he could, you know, pick up the baton and run with it.
It seems to me, though, that the text would necessitate, if you're going to take that, it does not refer to Christ in that context. And I think that it very well could. In fact, I think that it does, because of what continues on in chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, which is where I want to end our study in 12, 1 and 2 in just a few minutes. But that the idea was is that the God's anointed would be God's people. In other words, that the reference to God's anointed, if it's not referring to the Christ, would be referring to the children of Israel themselves.
And Moses was one of them.
Yeah. And he's choosing to throw in with the chosen of God. They referred to themselves and certainly were God's chosen people.
So I just wondered if the translators had taken that God's anointed and said, okay, that's Christ, or whether it actually uses the word for Christ.
All I can tell you is that the commentators that I read in preparation for this all agreed that it was Christ.
I would say it wasn't. I'm just trying to get the most meaning out of it.
Well, there is one other thing that I want to bring up that's found in the text as well in verse 27, before we get into just maybe a couple of applications. You'll notice in verse 27, he says, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as in him who is invisible. And again, I think this again is a trust in God's power over Pharaoh's. And so there is that. But having said that, there is some courage that is to be considered here. Again, we would say, if I were to read the passage that I had is, where is it? Okay. I've got it somewhere in here, but I can't find it. But when Jesus said to fear not those who can destroy the body, but to fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. So we've got the relative power of God in that regard. Now, if we were to say that, who do you fear? Do you fear God or do you fear men? All of us say, we fear God. But what happens the next time someone comes up to you and says, either you do this or else, and there's some consequence? Either you, and again, in some ages, in some cultures, in some times, it was necessary for an individual, if he were to save his life, he must deny his Lord. And so it can even get to that point where you lose your life. Even in the first century, there were times when the persecution was so great that Christians who would not refuse their Lord and would not deny him, that they lost their lives as a result of it. So that's a possibility that might happen. So here, he didn't fear the wrath of the king. This is Pharaoh we're talking about here. This is an individual who had had the ability and had done this without God's help up to that period of time, enslaved people. Now, they were afraid of the people of Israel. That's why they enslaved them. But the people of Israel were slaves. And you'll remember how harsh the Egyptians were as taskmasters. And in fact, as the progress was ongoing after Moses' return and them finally leaving, they were required to make bricks without straw and still make as much many bricks as they did before when the straw was given to them. And it was really a difficult thing for them. So this was a tyrant. He was a capricious individual, and he had already enslaved them. And Moses had escaped death himself only because he was put into a basket in the river. And so this was a murderous individual. And we're told that Moses didn't fear him. So that's a pretty strong statement concerning the degree of faith that he had in his conviction. And so maybe if we talk about faith, we talk about what faith is. Faith is belief. Pistis, faith, belief. But we're to add to our faith virtue. That's the very first thing we're to add to our faith. And the term virtue, as it's found in that text, has reference to the strength of conviction. Our faith has to become strong so that it can withstand the difficulties of life. You have, in the example of the various seeds that the sower, or the seed that the sower sowed into the various soils, that one of the soils was rocky ground. And it sprang up immediately, but had no root. And so when difficulties came, it wilted. The plant wilted. And that described a kind of heart that is initially receptive to the gospel, but doesn't add to the faith virtue. There's no courage there. There's no strength of conviction there. And as long as things are going along fine, where there's no difficulties, their faith prospers. But the very first time that some difficulty presents itself, whether it be persecution or trial, or perhaps someone has the audacity to question your faith, or to ridicule you for what you believe, or disagree with you, then where do you go with it? And in this particular case, Moses, even in the face of the emperor, of the Pharaoh of Egypt, he stood with the people of God because he knew who God was, and that the one with him was greater than the one against him.
You know, along that line we talked about earlier about that brought about the mature Christian or those coming to maturity like that, they don't think like sacrifices and those things that we make decisions long before, like example with Joshua, he didn't ponder this morning, well, should I go to that meeting, business meeting at work, or should I be here at Bible class? I mean, he made that decision a while, long ago, you know. And whatever it is, you know, it might be some things we have to, but most times it's our maturity here, and that we've already decided, we, on Sunday morning, we don't get up, well, should I come to church or not? I mean, we get up and go, and that can be applied to so many things.
Oh, sure. And most of the things we apply it to are so much less problematic than the choice that Moses had to make that I think we ought to be ashamed sometimes when we have a difficult time making those decisions. I've got four applications, and we're out of time, so I'm going to do this just real quick. Four applications that I wanted to make sure we all understood. First of all, as we've indicated, spiritual things have greater value than material things. We quote in Matthew 16. Concerning gaining the whole world or losing your soul. Secondly, there is value in suffering for Christ. It's something that proves you, as James chapter 1 and verse 12 indicates, and as such you are shown to God to be worthy. Third, you can't choose both. You can't make yourself a friend of the world, because in doing so you make yourself an enemy of God. So that's the third point. We talked about that. And then finally, the pleasures of sin are only temporary. Roger indicated, and there's a text that I just kind of wanted to make note of, and we won't take the time to read it, but from Proverbs chapter 23 concerning wine, where it says, don't look at the wine and the sparkles in the cup, the passing pleasures of sin, because when it goes down, all of the descriptions of the evil that comes as a result of an individual who becomes drunk. The devil wants you to think it's great stuff. Just remember that all that is a facade. It's not really so. That all sin leads to is destruction. And so the pleasures of sin are very much temporary and very much surface pleasures. And then the only other thing I wanted to emphasize as we try to make maybe a suggestion on how it is that we can get back to that page real quick. How we can make the same choice that Moses made. I think that it's good that we end our time together in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Because again, that's the whole point. Moses made the choices, so how do we make the choices like he did? And the whole point of Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 is we've got their witnesses, their examples for us. They're up there looking at us, and they've done it before we've done it. So let us lay aside every weight, the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. So two things. Consider those who have gone on before, because they serve as great examples to us, and they can be very much an encouragement. And I don't want to mean it. I don't want to emphasize too much the idea that they shame us into action. But there is something of that here in this text. Look at what they did, and they did it not having received the promises. Since they did it having not received the promises, how much more able are we to do it having received the promise? In fact, Christ has come. And when we talk about them seeing through a veil darkly and living and died, they lived and died without ever experiencing the existence of a relationship with Christ in the present. We have that. That's an advantage that we have. And so if they could focus on the reproaches of Christ, how much more should we be able to focus on Christ, the author and finisher of our faith, and as such, be very diligent with regard to making the right choices, the choices of righteousness. I think it's just a wonderful lesson for us, and I would encourage you to read often Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, but read Hebrews 11 first, because you're going to go through it, and you're going to, one of the things about it, since Bill had run, of course, he waited for me to breathe so he can read it, but you'll notice in verse 32, when he says the things that fell in time to save these individuals, he said, they through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, but others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. All of these in this list, some evil stuff happened to these individuals, but they chose to suffer the reproaches of Christ rather than the pleasures of sin, just like Moses did. And that's the same choice that we must make as well. So the next time we think to ourselves, perhaps in a moment of immaturity, it's sure hard for me right now to do what Christ would have me to do. Go read that list. And then read chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And perhaps that might shame you a little bit into doing a little bit better. And at least focus your mind on serving Christ and making Him the first thing, most important thing in your life. Alright? So, it's already been 5 minutes, so we're going to stop now. And appreciate very much everyone's kind attention.